Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Let's try it again. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So we're here to talk about laws, and we are very glad you're here. Don't forget that. We're very glad you're here. Thanks for coming back again and again and again to listen to us talk. And I hope that you're being filled and inspired and stretched and encouraged and lots of other things too. And thank you, ladies, for moving to the front. We appreciate that. And the men too. I wasn't in here when you moved to the front, but thanks. Okay, why do we talk about laws? Connected with teaching. And what are some laws that you'd relate to in your life? Anybody?
Traffic laws.
Good. What else?
Parents.
Curfews. Good. What else? What was that?
God's
laws. Thank you. Okay. What about some laws in the natural world? What comes to your mind when you think of laws in the natural world?
The law of gravity.
Law of gravity.
Mathematics.
Good. Those are all things that connect with law. Probably when you think of the word law, you think of cause and effect. Okay? A certain cause produces a certain effect. Because of the law of gravity, if I stumble, which is the cause, I'm going to fall, which is the effect. That's because of the law of gravity. Because of the laws of the land, if you're caught driving over the speed limit, the cause, then you might get a ticket, which would be the effect. The Bible says that what we sow, which is the cause, we're going to reap the same thing. That's the effect. So, as a teacher, if you work to follow the seven concepts listed in this book, that's the cause, then you will be on the path to finding success in your classroom, and that's the effect. The author of this book would even go so far as to say that the only way a teacher can be effective is if he or she follows these seven laws. And he would say that every good teacher follows these laws, even if he has never seen them written out like they're written out in this book. He does it sort of subconsciously to some degree or another. How many of you like laws? Put your hand up if you think you like laws. That's kind of a strange question, maybe, and it might depend on the situation. Okay? To some people, it doesn't bring good pictures to mind, and we don't like laws, and we don't really like people telling us what to do, and it makes us feel like we're being too formal and too traditionalistic and just stuck in a box, and we just don't like laws, okay? And that is around us all over the place. The culture we live in is that way. But let's not forget what we're talking about. We're talking about laws for success. Now think about this. A good cook follows the laws of cooking, right? And she or he, but usually she, is able to make a delicious meal if she follows the laws of cooking. A good mason follows the laws of building, and he's able to build a beautiful brick structure. And it's that way with any job you do. You have to stay within the laws of your job or your activity in order to succeed. As soon as you try to break free from that law, then you have problems, and it causes many bad things to happen. And I want you to think about how a good cook, if she is creating a beautiful meal that tastes good and she's following the laws, there's tremendous freedom in that. It's not limiting her to what she can do. There's lots of freedom if she stays within the laws of cooking. Same way for a builder. You won't feel restricted if you're a cook and you're following the laws of cooking, because you just know you have to, and that's the way you're going to produce good food. So think about teaching the same way. Some of you, if you're teaching for the first time, you don't know very much yet as far as just practical day-to-day experience of teaching. You might not even really be able to articulate very well what you think the laws of teaching are or what it should include. But listen and try to absorb the things you're going to hear here in this class. work hard to learn them and try to use them every day and thrive within those boundaries. Just let yourself thrive within the boundaries of those laws. The man who wrote this book, John Milton Gregory, was passionate about teaching, and you don't have to read very far in this book to understand that. It just shines out of these pages that he was passionate about teaching and teaching well. He was also committed to Christ, and he published this book, The Seven Laws of Teaching, in 1884. However, in 1917, this book was revised by two professors, and I'm reading from here, from the introduction, by two professors from the University of Illinois during an era of widespread liberal changes in education across the United States. Even though every effort was made to retain both the form and substance of the original, according to the revisionists, the changes were very significant and secularizing. Virtually all references to Jesus Christ and the Word of God were expunged, along with many other alterations. So, if you buy this book, please buy this, the one that looks like this on the cover. There's another one out there that looks like that. I also saw one that's green. Don't buy that one, because it has some of the same stuff in it, but it was revised by secular men to try to make it more... I don't know what they were trying to do, but it doesn't have all the references to the Bible and such in it. So, you ready to begin this trip? We're going to be going across seven laws, and we're going to be going across them very quickly. So hold on tight. Your handout just has seven blanks where you can write down the seven laws, and then there's a little bit of space there in case you want to take any extra notes. If we have time at the end, we are going to do a little bit of review, so you can be thinking about that as we go through this. I will be sharing on the first two laws, then Brother Derek will share on laws 3 and 4, Brother Jonah on laws 5 and 6, and then I'll take law 7 and finish up the class. So, law number 1, the teacher must know that which he would teach. Really? Do you believe that? The teacher must know that which he would teach. You might be sitting here and thinking, well, now that is the most obvious statement I've heard in the whole history of WFTI. Of course we must know what we're going to teach. Of course we must. If I was going to try to teach someone how to sew a dress, yeah, it just wouldn't go well because I do not know how to do that. I don't have the skills for that. But if I was going to teach someone how to drive a tractor and pick up big square bales, I could teach them how to do that because I did that for a while and I know how that works. Believe it or not, there will be days in your teaching, very likely, where you're tempted to just not really pay attention to this law, that you have to know what you're going to teach. You must know the information that you're going to teach if you're going to be able to pass it on to someone else. In this chapter, the author shares 4 levels of knowledge, and we can summarize them like this. You can have the level of knowledge where you just recognize something, you just so recognize it. You can have, that might be like if you see a picture of a famous politician, you recognize their picture, but that's about all. You can have knowledge where you're able to recall it for yourself. You don't have to have something from the outside make you remember about this certain thing. You can pull it up from your own memory. Then there's the level of knowledge where you're able to do that and you're able to explain it. Okay, we're getting a little deeper here. And then there's the last level of knowledge is where you have all 3 of those things, but also you allow it to change you and allow it to change how you live. Okay, so there's faint recognition, then there's the level of being able to recall it yourself, and then there's being able to actually explain it to somebody else, and then there's where it actually changes you, changes how you live. The author presents 5 dangers in this thing about knowledge. And each one of these things could ruin your efforts individually. They each could. So here's one thing. My students don't know that much, so I'm sure that I know more than they do. So if I get to class and I haven't studied much, well, I'll be fine because I know more than they do. That might be true, but that's a dangerous place to go. You will set yourself up for a very humiliating experience if you do that. So that's one danger. The second danger, the student's the one that needs to be studying and working hard to know the material, not me. It's more important that the student studies, and it is important that the student studies, but the student better know that his or her teacher also understands what's going on. The third danger is thinking we know enough to get through the period, and thinking that if we don't quite have enough to fill up the period, well, we can just fill the rest of it up with random things. Another danger is making up fancies of our own and trying to hang those fancies on the general idea of the lesson. So you're kind of connecting it to the lesson, but it's mostly just kind of this made-up stuff that you're just talking, and it doesn't really apply that well. And the last danger is using big words and fancy expressions to hide the fact that you don't really know very much about the subject you're talking about. And your students will be able to see through that, so just don't put them through that. Just know the subject you're going to teach. Probably all of you have sat in an audience and listened to someone talk about something that you could tell they were passionate about. Maybe it was about constellations, or maybe it was about farming, or maybe it was about whatever the subject. But you just sit there and listen, and you just stare at them, and just like soaking it all in, and you look at the clock and realize that 45 minutes just passed. You've probably all experienced that. Why? Well, because that person knew what they were talking about. They knew their topic. So a couple things that we can do to help us in this area. Study fresh every time. When you're coming up on a lesson, study fresh every time. Compare the lesson to more familiar things. Compare it to familiar things. Make sure you use clear language. And I know I'm going through these fast. If you want me to give them to you later, I will be glad to. Use clear language. In every lesson, you will be able to find a progression from the simplest concept to the most complicated concept, and try to find that progression and start with the simple and end with the more complicated. Relate the lesson to students' lives. Use legitimate aids. If you were in Jonah's class on presentation, he shared lots of aids you can use. Keep this in mind. It's better to learn a few things well than lots of things not very well. Another thing you can do is intentionally set aside a time to study each lesson. Have a plan to study each lesson, but don't hesitate to go beyond that and study more than what you planned. And read and ask questions to learn more about the topic and focus. Let's say the law number one together. The teacher must know that which he would teach. Thank you. Law number two, the law of the learner, says, the learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. The learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. This law shifts from talking about the teacher to talking about the pupil. And you may be thinking, well, that's the pupil. What am I supposed to do about the pupil? Because I'm the teacher, not the pupil. Let's look at it a little bit. One of the wonders of our minds is that we can look like we're completely engrossed in what's going on, but our minds can be thousands of miles away, and we're not actually listening to what's going on. We're just there, and it looks like we're listening. That's an amazing thing that we can do, but it's not a good thing when it comes to this thing of attention and the learner. So this chapter talks about three different kinds of learning. Attention. There's passive attention. That would be like a little child where his attention just flips from one thing to the next just that fast. It's passive attention. There's active attention where you actually can focus on something. Like you make an intentional effort to focus, and then you're focused on it. You're not just flitting from all the things that are coming into you. And then the last one is called secondary passive attention. And this is the kind of attention where it gets you so absorbed in it that you're just being carried along, and you kind of feel like you don't really have any control over it. It's just so absorbing that you're just being pulled into it. It requires lots of effort, and it attracts us, so it's both. It's like passive attention, where it does attract us, but it also requires us to put forth lots of effort to get there. So think about a ship. It's very unlikely that a ship with a sail, if it's just left to itself, will randomly get blown into a safe harbor. Could happen, but it's very, very unlikely. Think about your students that way. A student that's left to his own will very likely not end up in a safe harbor. He needs your direction to help him learn how to concentrate, learn how to do that. Remember, it's learned. It's not a natural thing to be able to concentrate. Okay, another key concept in this chapter is that a student will not retain things if you just tell them to him. He won't retain things if you just tell them to him. Here's a quote out of the book. "The notion that the mind is only a receptacle in which to stow other people's ideas is entirely incorrect." Think about that and listen to that. Your students' brains are not made for you to just pour things into them and then leave them at that. That's not how they're going to learn. They have to think for themselves. The mind is a muscle, and if they don't use their mind muscle, they're not going to learn how to make it strong. Just like if you don't use your arm muscles, they get weak. Ask questions. Get their attention. If you have their attention, they will be interested. So let's think about that. Four things to avoid. Don't start a lesson if you don't have the attention of your students. Two, don't force them to listen after their powers of attention have been exhausted, because they do get to that point sometimes where they almost physically can't focus anymore. So don't push them past that point. Make sure you know your students and what their favorite things or activities are. Don't avoid that. And take advantage of new ways to explain things. Don't get stuck in the rut of just always doing it the same way every single time. Some rules you can follow. And again, I'm going to go through these very quickly. Pause if their attention is broken, and wait till you have their attention again before you start up again. Change the length of class based on the age of the students. It's okay if the classes are shorter or longer. Use variety when you present stuff, but try not to do distracting things. Make sure you keep your interest in the subject high. And you will find that it's easy to do that with some subjects and harder with other ones. That's the way it is. Make your lesson relevant to the age you're teaching. Appeal to their interests. Know what their favorite songs, stories, and subjects, and foods, and games. Know those things about your students and use that. Keep distractions inside and outside the classroom to a minimum. Think about thought-provoking questions that you can ask them, but have those ready beforehand. It's hard to come up with them on the spot sometimes. Make your presentation colorful, but don't overdo it. Remember, don't distract. You want to make them interested, but you don't want to distract them from the objectives that you're trying to perform or trying to accomplish. Maintain your enthusiasm and learn how to use your eyes and your hands to communicate. What did Jonah say about eyes and hands in one of his classes? Can somebody tell us? Anybody remember? Okay, spread your arms out. Don't just keep your elbows in like this. Use your hands. That'll get their attention. And make eye contact often with your students. Okay, that's Law 2. I'll turn the time over to Derek for Laws 3 and 4.
All right. Write this down, please. La número 3. El lenguaje utilizado en la enseña debe común al profesor y al alumno. Aren't you all right? These students won't listen to me. No, the language... Law 3. The language used in teaching must be common to teacher and learner. The language used in teaching must be common to teacher and learner. And like Conrad said, some of these facts are so obvious. They're so painfully obvious that we miss them sometimes. The language used in teaching must be common to teacher and learner. You know, how many of you speak a different language than what your students do when you teach? Okay, good. How many of you struggle with hippopotamonstrosis quipedalophobia? Can you repeat that one, please?
Hippopotamonstrosis quipedalophobia.
Hey, wow, very good. So she doesn't have it, obviously. It's the fear of reading or pronouncing long words. The fear of long words. But most of y'all didn't know what I was talking about. Here's a quote from Eugene Meltzner. He said, he wishes to specifically, I wish to curb my desire to exhibit my perspicacity. Do you wish to curb your desire? Do you have a desire to exhibit your perspicacity? Do you?
I don't know.
He said that one time, and Wooten says, have you tried deodorant? Don't y'all understand English? That's not Spanish. That's English. You know, sometimes we use words that our students don't understand. Perspicacity means, another word would be wordy or verbose, someone that likes to use big words. So maybe I have a desire to exhibit my perspicacity when I wrote hippopotamonstrosis clipidalophobia on the board. All right. Here's another one. How many of y'all like to play disc golf? Oh, great. So do you prefer to use the Anheuser on the backhand or forehand? Yeah. Did you say you played disc golf?
Yeah, I played it.
Oh, okay. Do y'all prefer to use the forehand or backhand when you do an Anheuser? Or do you mostly throw a hyzer? Hey, those are words. Those are English words. I didn't know what they meant either until recently. And I had to choose bigger words because you probably won't use words like that in your classroom. But, you know, sometimes you use words that they don't know what they mean. And all it takes is one word in a sentence that you don't know the meaning of, and their students are lost. And you're like, did you understand that? Can you explain it to me? Can you repeat that or something? Just like there was one student that he asked his teacher, he said, why do we get grades in art? Why are we graded for art? And the teacher says, well, it's just for an incentive. Okay. And then the teacher heard him asking his older brother, what's incentive? He didn't know what incentive meant. I hope you do. Another time, I was working with someone putting up gutters, and I asked him, how do you deal with conflict in your marriage? He's like, conflict? We don't have conflict in our marriage. I was like, okay, really? I need to talk to you some more. Said, we have conflict in our marriage. I said, sometimes I think that, you know, the more conflict you have, the better your marriage is, or at least if you talk about your conflicts. Well, that was the beginning of a really long conversation with him. But we had our understanding of conflict was different. He viewed conflict as more of a fight, you know, or war, where you're trying to hurt the other person, where I looked at it as just simply a difference in opinion. But we can have the same word and it can mean different things to different people. So make sure when you're teaching, make sure to use words that your students understand. Make sure they're simple. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to stretch them. Please teach them new words, like hippopotamonstrosis clipidalophobia or pneumono ultramicroscopic silico-volcano coniosis. You know, teach them words like that. It's kind of fun for them sometimes. Or other words. But take it one at a time and explain it clearly. Even if, perhaps when you're doing spelling words, you know, make sure you clearly explain each word, what it means. Make sure they understand so that you can build their vocabulary gradually, because they can't just add, you know, 10 words a day. I guess not. I don't know. I've never really tried to add that many a day. But be careful about adding too many. Make sure you use words that they can understand. Make sure the language used in teaching must be common to teacher and learner. Sorry, I'm going overtime already. Okay, law 4. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. And I'm just going to illustrate this on the board. So let's say you're teaching fractions. Again, that was the truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. So if you're adding fractions, what's 1/3 plus 1/4? I'm still writing. Okay. Very good. Your students may not know that when the first time you teach them that. So they might be lost. You can't just
You have to go back. You know, when they've come to this problem in the book, hopefully they've already learned two things. There's two things you have to know in order to solve this problem. What are they? Okay, perhaps. I'm talking about two principles. One is least common multiple. You have to know how to find the least common multiple. And you have to know how to add like fractions. This is adding unlike fractions. So you have to know how to add like fractions. You have to know least common multiple. That's two things. And they've already learned both of those things already. You can't teach this if they haven't learned that. So, you know, you say, well, at least common multiple, multiples of a number. So we have the multiples of 3 are 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, and so on. The multiples of 4 are 4, 8, 12. And there's different ways to do this. I know different curriculums teach it differently, but we just look and we find numbers that are the same. Oh, 12 is the same. And 24 is the same. So we, this marker is there. Okay, what's the least common multiple? The lowest common multiple is 12, that's right. And what's 1/5 plus 3/5? Remember, they already know that you add the numerators, so we have 4/5. We don't add the denominators. And then we take those two skills and we teach them, okay, so with 1/3 and 1/4, you have to change the like fractions first. And so what's the lowest common multiple of 3 and 4? And they already know, okay, yeah, remember back there? Yeah, it's 12. And so we, maybe I skipped it. Maybe there's another concept you have to know. I guess it would be the equivalent fractions. They would need to know that as well. I forgot about that. You have to know that in order to make equivalent fractions, you have to multiply them both by the same number. So we multiply 3 times 4, and so we go this times 4 as well. That's how you make equivalent fractions. So actually it's 3 things. And then we have 4 twelfths, and then here we have multiply by 3, multiply by 3. And again, you already know this stuff. The point of it is we have to teach through what is already known. So many times we're just hammering on this one thing and they're not getting it. And then, you know, we realize that, oh, they're missing. You can't build a brick. Have you ever tried to build a brick wall? We talked about masons earlier. Have you ever tried to build a brick wall and skip the second row? No, it wouldn't work. You have to take it layer by layer. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. Direct objects. You can't teach direct objects if students don't know what nouns are. A direct object is always a noun. A direct object is a noun or pronoun that follows the action verb and receives the action from the verb. And hopefully you say that 100 times this year. And they know that it's a noun. Noun's name. And so, you know, the direct object will never be found in a prepositional phrase. You'll say that 100 times too. So anyway, you teach the new concept through ones they already know. It's just putting it together. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known.
During my first year of teaching, I had this wonderful idea for our first art project. We had these hooks in the men's. We actually had two different entries, one for the gentlemen and one for the ladies. And we had hooks where each of the students was supposed to place their jackets, their shoes, their lunchbox, and so on. And I thought it would be so fun to make our own little sticker. And I would just put contact paper and everyone could make their own. And this would be our first art project. And it's a pretty good idea, right? And so I tell everyone that this is what we're going to do, and you can make your own design and write your name on it. You can choose what color construction paper you want to use, and then we'll cut them out and we'll use contact paper and we'll stick them underneath these hooks, and then we get to look at them all the rest of the school year. And so I'm up there at my teacher's desk cheerfully drawing a little whale, looks happy, and signing my name inside it. And somebody raises their hand and says, I want to draw a semi. Well, sure, go ahead and draw a semi. I'm having trouble. And they come up and it looks kind of like this, you know, and I'm
I'm thinking, yeah, okay, well, what we need to do, and I start working with this student, helping him draw his semi, and pretty soon somebody else is saying, I can't draw a barn. And I don't know how long it was. It might have been 10 minutes into art class, and there was literally a line of students trailing away from my desk, all waiting for me to draw their pictures for them. Law 5 is the law of teaching. That's not what you're supposed to write down. It's the law of the teaching process. And it says that the teaching process is to excite and direct the self-activities of the learner. This is a little bit of a longer law. And tell him nothing that he cannot learn himself. Not saying that right. Correct. Excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing that he cannot learn himself. If you don't want to say all of that, I will give you the short version. And that is, he teaches best who teaches least. All right. There are three things I'm going to tell you about this law. The first one is that the person working is the person learning. So when I was having art class, who was learning? I was. The students learned absolutely nothing that day. It was a total teaching failure. Okay. How did you learn how to walk? Someone taught you? Showed you a book of pictures how to walk? First, you take the weight off of one foot and we're on the other one. And no, we just tried. We had the way that people learn is by doing things, by practicing. So, this law would say that you have to make your... It's not wrong for you to walk as a teacher. Show them this is how you walk. But if I want Kurt to learn how to walk, you have to get up and walk with him.
Maybe walk for just a little bit.
Yeah, good job. He can do this.
Thank you.
That, now we got learning happening. All right.
The second thing is that he teaches best who teaches least. Did I say that already? It's okay. Because it's the most important thing in this law. In the book, The Seven Laws of the Learner, he uses the term irreducible minimum. When you boil that concept down to the smallest possible thing. Too many teachers sow plants instead of seeds. Jesus taught the seed is the word of God. The seed is a very small version of a plant. Right? Jesus was the master teacher. We can learn from him. The third thing is that we must light the love of knowledge, the reward of a new skill, the rejoicing in the truth in the heart of our students. It's not so much to be a wonderful teacher as to teach your students to be wonderful learners. How do you do that? Well, you adapt your lessons to their tastes, make it appetizing to them, and teach your students not only how to find good answers, but how to ask the right questions. And the best way to do that is by answering their questions with a question. Don't you think so? Pupils become thinkers then, and they become discoverers. And that brings us to Law 6, which states that the learner must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be acquired. Law 6 states that the learner must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be acquired. This summer I had the pleasure of rebuilding a glue press that we use in the cabinet shop that I tried to help in during the summer times. And this glue press has a leveler that is air powered. It wasn't working right. So I
went online and found some parts that I thought might fix it, and ordered them, and went back to the glue press and realized I had no clue what I was doing, and I had purchased the wrong parts. You see, I had the wonderful experience of having to study and learn about pneumatics.
Does anyone know what this is?
If you study pneumatics, you would know that that is actually the diagram for a pneumatic valve, also known as a pneumatic switch. It's just a switch that turns air on or off and sends it going a certain direction. And those little lines are supposed to represent which direction the air flows when the switch is in a certain position. And I had to learn how to read these things so that I could buy the right switch that would fix the glue press and would make things work. And it worked. But I had to study. I had to learn. I had to reproduce in my own mind how to fix this thing. The statement that I read yesterday by Patrick White, I'll read it again. I don't remember what I was taught. I only remember what I learned. Learning is different from discovery. Discovery is when I find out that there's gold in my creek. Woohoo! Right? Does that do me any good? No. I have to go out there and dig that stuff out, process it, and then save it up so that I can come to WFTI next year. There are five levels of discovery. First one is a learner can repeat a lesson word for word. This is like when I tell you that a noun is a word that names a person, place, thing, or idea. What is a noun?
A word that names a person, place, or idea.
Okay, but does that really do you any good? No. The second thing is when a pupil adds clear understanding to the thought, so students can start using the lesson. For example, you can give me an example of a noun. So a noun is...
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a common noun. So we're stretching this thing a little bit. House?
Fish.
Good. All right. The third level is a student can translate the lesson accurately, so they can now give me a definition for nouns that does not follow word for word the one that I gave you. So just make up a different definition for a noun. What is a noun? Don't give me the down pat thing. A noun is a word that what? What do nouns do? Show action or being.
They describe a thing.
Describe a thing. Okay. That might confuse some people, but it's good. You have the idea. We've got the idea. So once a person can restate something and say nouns are naming words, nouns are words that we use for objects, or something like that. You can restate the idea of what we're talking about. The fourth level is a learner begins to see evidence for the lesson. So we start connecting dots. Are nouns only words? Could a noun be a phrase? Yeah, like Brent Stolzfus. Now we know which Brent we're talking about, and so on. Or it might even be a clause. For example, that which was from the beginning, which we have seen, which we have heard, which our hands have handled, and so on. That's naming a theme. And the fifth level of the student studies the applications of what they have learned. So now they know what it is, they can restate it. Now they're using it. This would be a student grabbing a thesaurus while they are doing a writing assignment so that they can find the perfect noun. So rather than saying monster, they would say a Komodo dragon was descending upon them with flaming tongue.
And the last law is the law of review. It says the completion, test, and confirmation of the work of teaching must be made by review and application. The completion, test, and confirmation of the work of teaching must be made by review and application. This is arguably the most important one. They're all important. I'll read it one more time. The completion, test, and confirmation of the work of teaching must be made by review and application. There's three aims when you're reviewing. You're trying to perfect knowledge, confirm knowledge, and make the knowledge ready and useful. Make it ready and useful. Knowledge doesn't do any good if you can't use it, so keep that in mind. Another quote from the book. No time in teaching is spent more profitably than that spent in reviewing. No time in teaching is spent more profitably than that spent in reviewing. Reviewing is not just repetition. Review involves repetition, but not all repetition is real review. You probably have experienced that when you read a book a second time, or a third time, or a fourth time, if you're an avid reader. You see things in the second, third, fourth time that you didn't see the first time. You probably have experienced that with the Bible. You hear a passage explained a little differently, and it's like, whoa, I never thought of that before. That's review. That's what we're talking about here. There's a quote. It says, "Beware of the man of one book." Beware of the man of one book. It's a terribly interesting quote. You don't want to get into an argument with that man about that book, because that man knows everything there is to know about that book, and he's read one book over and over and over. It's an extreme, but it's a very interesting thought. Reviews must be spread out over hours, days, weeks, even years. They can't all just be piled at one spot. You've got to review all the time. The only way that a person will learn is through review. A lot of the things we do by habit, we do it because we've done it so many times, we just do it automatically. Remember that review by itself, if we're just piling up facts on top of each other, is not worth anything. If we don't take the knowledge and make it change us, or let it change us, it becomes vanity of vanities, like Solomon said. So there's a few things we want to avoid. Completely neglecting review. Obviously you want to avoid that. Not doing enough review, maybe because you didn't prepare for it, or you're trying to get through the course fast rather than getting on top of all the concepts. A third thing to avoid is putting off review till all the way at the end of the year. That's obviously not a good idea. And the fourth thing is just lifeless and colorless review. Okay, students, today we're going to review nouns. Can somebody give me an example of a noun? No. That's not going to get their attention. It's not going to make them excited about reviewing. Maybe you need to bring a different kind of noun that they've never seen before, like a Komodo dragon. If you can, that'd be great. Do something. Some other rules in connection with review. Review is always in order. There's never a bad... review is always good. Set times for review. If you can, review at the end of every class. Just a little bit of a review on what you studied. Expanding that, you can review some after you've done maybe 5 or 6 lessons. Go back and review the lessons. New lessons should review and apply former lessons. So that's what Derek was talking about, building on what they know already. Review a lesson as soon as possible after you've taught it. Don't wait 3 or 4 days to come back to that concept that you taught. Be prepared to do impromptu reviews. That'll get their attention, and they might realize that, hey, my teacher might just have this random review that I better be ready for, especially if it involves candy or throwing things or something that they're not expecting, and they're like, oh, I wish I would have been ready for that. And I think that's where we'll stop with those applications for the law of review. Okay, is your head swimming yet with all this stuff? Good. Great. There's so much here. It's normal. Remember to pray lots. God will give you wisdom on how to use these laws. Now, let's just do a very quick review. We're going to use the 7th law a little bit. I want to see if we can, without looking at our papers, can somebody tell me what the law number 1 is? Or it can be in your own words, definitely. What's law number 1? Say that again. You have to know what you teach. And what's one thing that any one person maybe wrote down from that point, from that law? Anybody? Remember anything specific? That's it.
Sometimes you might want to teach it
Good. Thank you. Law number two. Anyone? Good try. Let's have another try.
The learner has to be excited about.
Thank you. The law of the learner. Good. And what's one thing about that that you remember? Use things that they're interested in. Very good. The third law, the law of the language. Derek shared on this one. What is that law?
Students and the teacher need to speak the same language.
Good. They need to speak the same language. If you know both know a foreign language, maybe you can use it. But what's one thing we remember from that point?
Even if you're talking in English, they still might understand you.
Very good. Very good. I love this joke. I love using big words. It makes me feel so photosynthesis. Keep that in mind. Okay. The law of the lesson. Law number four. What's the law of the lesson? Derek shared on this one also.
Build
on what they already knew. Very good. And we're going to keep going here. What's law number five? Law number... Yeah, five. The law of the teaching process. Jonah shared on this one. What's that law? That was the longer one. You can give the short version if you remember what it is. Anybody?
He teaches best who teaches least.
Thank you. He teaches best who teaches least. What's the law of the learning process? Second to last one. It's the second one that Jonah gave. The person that's working is the one that's learning. Very good. And the last one is the law of review. Can somebody read or quote for us what that law is?
The completion, test, and confirmation of the work of teaching must be made by review and application.
Thank you. So we review so that we can what it to our lives?
Apply
it to our lives. God bless you all. Have a good rest of your day. See you tomorrow. You're dismissed.